Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. We're very pleased to have as our guest today a major figure in social activist networks over the last 50 years, noted American singer, songwriter, actress, and social activist Holly Neer, who will return to Tulsa this weekend for a concert Friday evening. Neer is best known for her role in the aftermath of the shooting of San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk back in 1978, when she composed what would become an anthem in the social justice movement, We Are a Gentle, Angry People, also known as Singing for Our Lives. Another notable song came from her time as a cast member of the Broadway musical Hair. She participated in the silent vigil staged by the cast after the shootings at Kent State University, which inspired her song It Could Have Been Me. Neer has since worked on all sorts of social justice movements over her career and has recorded 25 albums, including one with the group Emma's Revolution, who will jointly appear with her Friday evening in her performance. Over her career, she's worked with countless socially active musicians, including Arlo Guthrie, Ronnie Gilbert, Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Brown, and Pete Seeger, for which there will be a tribute during the concert. She'll be appearing Friday evening at All Souls Unitarian Church, and she joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Holly Neer, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us, and we're looking forward to your appearance with Emma's Revolution here in Tulsa.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, too. It's been way too long since I've been in Tulsa.
When I look at your career arc, I mean, you've been involved with social justice from an incredible young age. In fact, I read a story that said, you know, you started thinking about just social justice even in grade school when you befriended some Native American children and first experienced racism. Is that correct?
Yeah, I grew up with Native American children as well as children of Oklahoma Dust Bowl refugees, people who came to California looking for work. Those families ended up, many of them, settling in the part of Northern California that I came from. So there were children of from real poor and working class backgrounds, as well as Native Americans, and as well as some of the, there were Italians that had come in and Portuguese, people who had come to the United States on a great wave of immigration. And it was an interesting place to grow up. And my parents were pretty interested in having their children be sensitive to human beings. And we were taught right from the beginning to treat everybody with respect and with equality.
Well, that's kind of an unusual attitude for that day and era. I mean, what was your reaction to the first time you experienced racism and saw that in action?
Well, it felt shameful. It felt disrespectful. It felt surprise. I remember feeling, why would somebody behave like that? I think children come into the world really ready to be decent folk. And what happens is these little tiny brains that are developing, these little souls, they see behavior and they start to monkey it. And so if you happen to grow up around people who treat other people with respect, that's how that child learns. If you grow up around somebody who's defensive and hostile and violent, then that's what you learn. And it's not that we can't recover from our parents, but I think that I try very hard now when I'm around young people to watch my language and watch how I behave, because they're paying attention. I really feel like they're watching.
Well, how did that form your reaction to what you did? Because I know you were an actress. You were also singing as early as high school. I mean, you must have been very much influenced by the folk revival in the early 60s. Was that influential on you?
I certainly listened to the music that was coming out of that time, and even before, like the Weavers that Pete Seeger and Ronnie Gilbert were part of, and then Woody Guthrie, of course, which you all know there,
yes.
And Paul Robeson, just on and on, lists and lists of people. Then there was the kind of next generation of folk, the younger ones that came along, and I found it all very interesting, and I was grateful, I think would be the word, that there was some music out there that was trying to understand who we are as human beings living on this planet. And but juxtaposed to that, this is interesting, is that I was very interested in jazz and musical theater and standards, and listened to Ella Fitzgerald and listened to the great singers of the 50s and the American Songbook. So when I went out to finally have a career of my own, it became this mix, which I guess I didn't know at the time, but kind of became the signature of who I am as a singer, is that I have a very theatrical and sort of cabaret-style voice. And I oftentimes work with a pianist more than guitars. So the music is the coming together of what is usually identified as folk music, because the lyrics may be talking about something about humanity. But oftentimes the singing style is more coming out of musical theater and cabaret. So it's been fun to develop it, and not always easy to figure out how to explain it because it doesn't really fall into a genre.
Well, the most recent recording is, it does embody that foot in each camp. I mean, there are songs of social justice, and there's standards like,
I've grown accustomed to your face.
Yes, exactly.
From Little Indians on there, done in a very jazz kind of way. And the thing that I do try to do, even if I pick a song that's written by somebody else, like there's a CeeLo Green song on there called Crazy. There's an Irving Berlin song. There's songs that come from a variety of genres, but I always try to pick a lyric and I feel is respectful of the listener. Mm-hmm. And I don't like to do songs where somebody's getting hurt and insulted. So
that leaves out a lot of "He Done You Wrong" songs.
It sure does. It sure does. I sang a few of those when I was in high school, but I had a hard time getting those words out of my mouth with any genuine, those "I Can't Live Without You, Baby, Baby" songs. And I just remember at some point going, well, actually, I can. So why am I singing this?
That's funny. Yeah. What now? Have you ever recorded the Great American Songbook songs before, or is this something new on this new album, "Peace Becomes You"?
I did do one recording that is sadly out of print at the moment, but it's called "With a Song in My Heart," and it was all songs from the 40s, that same American Songbook period, and with just voice and piano, very simple. I was tempted to do what Linda Ronstadt did and get a lush orchestra, and then I thought, first of all, I can't afford that, and second, I really want to figure out if I can just sing these songs the way my mom sang them to me, almost as lullabies, and that was really, turned out to be the right choice for me, and I hope at some point I can get that CD put back out again and put it back in print. But almost every recording I've done, I try to pull in a few songs that are not written by me or that are not overtly about a peace and justice issue, but that is personal, that's about the very personal human experience, because that's a hugely important part of who we all are. And so I like to throw some of those in. And I also really work hard not to be too rhetorical. It's a challenge when you're doing social justice music to remember you're writing a song and not giving a speech. there's two really different things.
I would think that would be very difficult because, you have a way you wish to express it, and you have to change it for a song lyric to be poetic, to serve the master of the melody, and you can't get too wordy. You just can't. It destroys the song.
Well, you can get wordy, but you have to be careful what those words are. I think one thing that we don't want to do is offend or insult an audience by boring them. The songwriter needs to keep the listener engaged. So no matter what the subject is, whether it's a love song or whether it's a social justice song, the songwriter's job is to make it fascinating, interesting, curious, funny, any of those things. So the audience member, the listener, is leaning into it. So, well, and then what happened? And then what happened? And I try as a songwriter to make sure that there's room for the listener to be a part of that emotional experience. And when I was younger, I wrote some songs that were kind of hammer songs, hit you over the head and see how you survive. As I got older and more mature, I started realizing that one didn't have to do that. And at the same time, there's nothing that can't be written about. That's the challenge for writing about peace and justice, is to say there is no subject that can't be turned into an emotional or poetic expression. But it takes practice. There's some wonderful, wonderful songwriters in the country, and I love discovering them.
Well, let's hear a little music by you. This is from your most recent recording. It's the title track from "Peace Becomes You." Is there a story about this particular song?
There actually is. I wrote the lyric, and I was having a hard time getting the music to fit the lyric. And so there was a friend of mine named John Fromer, lived in California, and he was a labor organizer, wonderful guitar player, singer, did a lot of work to promote peace and justice and humanity and respect, all the things you've been talking about. But he was dying of cancer, and I called him and I said, I don't know if you still feel like writing. And he said, oh yeah, I do. And so I sent him the lyric, and he wrote the music, and he wrote music right up until the hospice people were in his room. He wanted to keep writing. And so this is one of the last songs he wrote. I'm really honored that he wrote to my lyric. I'll always think of him when I sing it.
Well, let's hear that. This is the title cut from Holly Near's most recent recording, Peace Becomes You.
In your baggy jeans, I like the way you walk with your sassy stride. I like the way you sound when you call out my name, the way you laugh when you've got something to hide. But most of all, I like how you trust in change. And honey, darling, wonderful and true. May I say, peace becomes you. May I say, peace becomes
you. My guest today from her most recent recording, Peace Becomes You. Holly Near is my guest today, who will be appearing Friday evening at 7:30 at All Souls Unitarian Church with the group Emma's Revolution. And this is a group that you have worked with a couple of times. Tell me a little bit about Emma's Revolution and your relationship as performers.
I was singing at a peace event that was put on by, I think, a council of churches, if I remember correctly, in Washington, D.C., and they were all there to go and talk to their representatives about, gosh, I'm trying to remember which invasion it was, but there was some big, probably when our country was invading Iraq. At any rate, there they were, and I was singing, and I heard them humming in the wings, and I looked over, and I just sort of nodded them on, and they came on and sang harmony very spontaneously to my song, and they sounded fantastic. And I said, we should do this again sometime. And we've been singing off and on together ever since. I think that might have been in 2008 or 2007, something like that.
Uh-huh. And you eventually made a recording together?
We did. And they are the kind of singers that they find these really unique harmonies. They're not always just simple three-part triad harmonies. In fact, my recording engineer was commenting on how quick they were. There was a piece that we wanted to add some harmonies to, and they just sort of huddled for a minute, went blah, 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 and they came back and said, okay, we're ready, you can roll the tape recorder, and they sang gorgeous harmonies. So it's really a pleasure for me to work with them.
Now, you're going to actually sing together and actually have a little bit of a sing-along. You're going to do a bunch of Pete Seeger songs, I understand, for this concert, right, together?
We're going to do a few, yeah. We're going to do a little tribute to Pete, because Pete's been in our lives, all of us, for a long time. We've been friends with him and worked with him. And when we spoke to the people who are presenting the concert, they asked if we could do a tribute to him. And so we'll do some of our own material. They'll do some songs, I'll do some songs, but we don't do separate sets. We just mix it up. We all stay on stage. We sort of song swap back and forth. And then towards the end, we'll honor Pete Seeger.
I know you've worked with Pete Seeger on and off for many, many years. What's your most enduring memory of him?
One of the tours I did with him was actually Ronnie Gilbert, who was the woman who sang with the Weavers, and Pete joined up with me and Arlo Guthrie, sort of two generations, and we toured a bit together. And that was really fascinating to have the generational mix, as well as Ronnie and I are both, I would say, a little bit more singers, cabaret, musical theater, and then they're both such folkies. So it was really fun to kind of bring that together. And to watch generations come into the audience, you know, before generations would come to those concerts, because there was the grandparents who knew Pete and Ronnie, and then the next generation who knew me and Arlo, and then their children, and then their children, you know.
Yeah, the kids.
Really,
yeah, right.
Lovely. And then we went to do a show in Ohio, and we were part of the Ohio State Fair, and the governor came and did a public apology to Pete and Ronnie for the way they were treated during the McCarthy period.
Wow.
Because the Weavers had gotten off the plane back in that day and were met by reporters. All of a sudden, your concerts have all been canceled. Nobody wants to take the risk to present you since the red baiting that had gone on. So all their tours were canceled. They pretty much couldn't get work. And so there we were at the state fair singing, and the governor did this public apology. That was very beautiful. I was pleased to be part of that. And then just to watch Pete be willing to sing anywhere. You know, he did concerts for sure, but he loved to just pull out his banjo on the street corner as well, or when he was in a classroom with kids, or he was a very spontaneous kind of singer, and very global in the way he thought, as well as local. You know, he did all that work in his own little community to clean up the Hudson River, and then he'd also do these tours that he and his wife go. She traveled all over the world to try to be, like, you know, peaceful ambassadors from the United States, because there's a lot of places in the world that are kind of afraid of the United States, and he would show up and try to become friends, and that was his style.
You mentioned Ohio, and of course, one of your most enduring songs came out of the Kent State shootings back in 1970. You were a member of the Broadway musical Hair. You were singing on Broadway, is that right?
I was. I was singing. I came to work that night, and everybody was in the dressing room looking very sad and shocked, and said, "The students have just been killed at Kent State, and what should we do?" And I was pretty naive at the time, even though I thought of myself as a conscientious person. I didn't really know much about world politics yet, and so I abstained from voting. I just said, I don't know enough to vote, but I'll go with the group. And the group decided to pause the show right before the finale and acknowledge what had taken place. Mm. That, I left here and came back to California to do a film. And I ran into Dean Kaler, who was one of the survivors, one of the students who, he's, you know, paraplegic now from that bullet, but he was doing some work in Los Angeles, and he asked if I would write a song for a memorial at Kent. And I said yes, and that became a song called It Could Have Been Me. And then afterwards, different verses kept coming up, because the chorus seemed to work for all kinds of things beyond Kent State, and a verse ended up being written about Victor Jara down in Chile, who was killed. He was a wonderful singer-songwriter. And verses about women who were organizing in Africa for their rights. And then, of course, a verse about Karen Silkwood in Oklahoma.
Right. And of course, unfortunately, you can just keep adding verses.
Yeah,
that's the way of the world.
People do. They still send me verses saying, "We just wrote one for our issue here or there." And it, to me, that's a great honor to have written a song that has a universal chorus that allows people to feel they can become part of the song. And I'm glad that song has been of use in that regard.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Holly Near singing It Could Have Been Me here on Studio Tulsa.
Shut down by a nameless fire one early day in May. Some people cried out angry, you should have shot more of them down. But you can't bury youth, my friend, youth grows the whole world round. It could have been me, but instead it was you. So I'll keep doing the work you were doing as if I were too. I'll be a student of life, a singer of songs, a farmer of food, and the writer of wrong. It could have been me, but instead it was you. And it may be me, dear sisters and brothers, before we are through. But if you can die for freedom...
That's music by my guest today, Holly Near. It's her song, It Could Have Been Me. She will be appearing with Emma's Revolution Friday evening at 7:30 at All Souls Unitarian Church. Still writing songs, still singing music, and singing Cabaret and the Great American Songbook, along with songs of social justice. And I imagine we'll hear a bit of both this Friday evening. And she is our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I wanted to ask you about one of your most famous songs. It's Singing for Our Lives. I guess it's actually in the Unitarian hymnal now. Is that right?
It is.
Wow, that's cool. Hymnals, you think of people who have been dead 100 to 150 years, but that's really cool.
Well, soon enough. I think that it's wonderful that song is there. I appreciate that they did it, and it's ended up in quite a few other songbooks, and it's been in a couple films. And it has a little life of its own. I wrote that song after Harvey Milk and Mayor Moscone were murdered in San Francisco. And there was such an anger in the city, and we were trying to figure out, you know, not to tell people don't be mad, but to help people put that anger to work rather than to turn it towards destruction. So I was driving towards the event that was going to happen, and I was trying to find a way to sing to people and not deny them their rage, but encourage them to find a place to put that anger. And so that's where the song came up. We are gentle, angry people singing for our lives. And again, many verses have been written since then that different groups have added because it has a singable chorus, and it's kind of become an anthem for people who are trying to create change in their communities.
What was the reaction of the community that night when you sang it at the rally? I mean, did you say, wow, this is something special? Or you said, well, I just wrote this. I think it did what it's supposed to do. You know, when you sing a song like that for the first time, do you realize this is going to be an important song that they're still singing, you know, 30 years later?
I didn't know that at the time, no. I knew that it had done its work that evening. I was glad that I had it and it was useful, but I had no idea that it would have wings and fly off and become something quite different over time from just that event. You know, it would take on a much more global identity than simply about Harvey and Mayor Moscone, even though I constantly track it back to that. And it was a time where there were a lot of people who were, it's hard to remember now because there have been so many changes, but people were still very afraid to be identified as gay. And Harvey Milk was the first, as far as I know, out civil servant. He was a county supervisor, and that just hadn't happened in the world at that time. And the fact that he was killed because his killer was anti-gay and took his violence out on Harvey, it was very disturbing to the city and to places around the world. So that song started out with a verse that was, we are gay and straight together, sort of calling on an allyship, because, of course, Mayor Moscone was not gay, and the two of them were friends, and trying to model a unified feeling about this human rights and civil rights issues. So the song kind of nailed it right there from the beginning, and then it became a good handle for people. It was a way that when I'd sing it in concert, I'd ask people to sing along, and for a lot of people in the early days, they'd never even said the word gay, much less sung it, and then pretty soon they'd all be holding hands and swaying together. And so it was an invitation to people to reach out to their best self and see if they could find that. Mm-hmm. And so the job of the song was quite large now, I see in hindsight. I didn't know that really at the time.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Holly Dear singing for our lives here on Studio Tulsa.
And we are singing for our lives. We are gentle, angry people. And we are singing for our lives. We are a land of many colors.
That's music of Holly Near, her wonderful song, Singing for Our Lives. She'll be appearing with Emma's Revolution this Friday evening at 7:30 at All Souls Unitarian Church. One last question that has to do with, you know, you've seen an enormous amount of changes, some good, some not so good. And I think that's sort of the way of social justice. But give me a sense, do you feel like more good has happened or more ill in the story of social justice? Because certainly while issues of sexual orientation has changed and acceptance of people have changed in a lot of ways, when you look at things like inequality, things are not so great. How do you view it? Are you an optimistic about it, a pessimistic, or somewhere in between?
Well, I have to say, I keep going back to nature when I get lost in that question, because nature comes and goes. It has seasons. It has a spring, and things sprout and bloom, and then there's this glorious summer and fall, and then everything dies, and it has to be rebuilt again. So I feel like it's part of who we are as nature, as animals, that things are not, okay, we did that. We got that right. Okay, now we can brush our hands of that and go do something else. I don't think it's like that, because every day there are new babies born. There's new people who are going to be growing into adulthood. They're going to have opinions. And one has to just keep revisiting the questions of what is humanity? How do we want to live together? There's kind of recent reports coming out that the United States is an incredibly dangerous place of falling into demise, because it has not put people's needs high enough up on the agenda, and that you can't have this many people living together and have them be in such a state of despair. It's not, you talk about national security, you got to have people cared for, or they're going to hurt each other, and they're going to hurt all of us. They're going to hurt the world. And so I think that we're a funny animal. We may be the only animal that sends its young out as a first line of defense. I don't know other animals that do that. And I don't know how many other animals abuse each other kind of in the way we do. So we've kind of run amok. But we also have the potential to do such amazing things. So I just kind of watch it like a season. You know, we go to our very best self, and then we swing back to this other side, and then we pull ourselves back up, and we swing to our very best. And I think we're quite an extraordinary species, yes. And it's a multiple planet. And I do hope we can figure out how to keep the world spinning. But it's in a pretty precarious place right now. It's on the downswing in a lot of ways, and that makes me sad.
If I can extend your metaphor a little bit, we're also the only animal that will care for another animal that we have no knowledge of, no relationship, or no connection to whatsoever. So that's the hopeful part.
Because we can know a couple species that are pretty nice.
Yeah.
And we have this potential, this extraordinary potential. And people have the possibility of change. I heard about this guy who was a high commanding officer in the war against Vietnam, and he'd seen so much death and destruction. And he came back and he felt like that had been a mistake. So he goes into this hospital down in Southern California and holds mature babies and rocks them. And that's his retirement. Every day he goes in there and he takes care of the new babies. And you sort of go, wow, isn't that a transformation? That's extraordinary.
It is.
So here we are, these beings that have so much potential. And when you look at the Olympic artists and the athletes, and you look at the scientists and the doctors and the artists, and you just say, whoa, look what we're capable of. And I just keep holding on to that, to work with young people and to work with each other to say, let's keep looking at what we're capable of. We might actually be even capable of preserving this planet from ultimate destruction if we put our minds to it, because we are capable of doing some pretty amazing things.
Holly Neer, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Singer-songwriter and social activist Holly Neer speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her most recent album is titled Peace Becomes You. She'll be joined by Emma's Revolution in a concert Friday evening at 7:30 at All Souls Unitarian Church. Well, Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. We're going to leave you with music by Holly Neer and Emma's Revolution.
When you speak the language of your life, I do not know the story. The words are only sounds, and they leave my mind to wonder. Perhaps you speak of the mountains.